going to be speaking to you today regarding data privacy and who's collecting it, why they're collecting it, and what you can do to help prevent it. What I'm going to start out with here is retail stores. I'm going to focus mostly on grocery stores, and since I'm from the area here, specifically Giant Eagle stores, as that's the store I'm most familiar with.
Yeah, I don't know if the mic's really working.
Yeah, the mic's just recording, but can you speak up a little bit?
Okay, sure.
Great.
That's always a thought.
Well,
what they collect, basically anything they can get their mitts on. If you take a look at a Giant Eagle Advantage card application, what you'll see is they collect the basic stuff, name, address, phone number, email address. They also collect your phone number, if you choose to give it to them, and your Social Security number. Social Security number is optional if you're just using the card to enjoy the savings, but if you're using it for check cashing or for writing checks, you do need to provide your Social Security number to them in advance on the card. Why they collect it is pretty simple. Obviously, there is a profit motive in there. They sell the aggregate data to various organizations to help gauge what the purchasing habits are within that location and across their footprint as a whole. They also use that data internally for operational efficiency. It allows them to stock the stores somewhat in a more efficient fashion. The savings that are offered through the card do not come from the store itself. In most cases, not all, but most cases, the discounts that the use of the card gives you are straight from the manufacturer. These 5-10 years ago were what were known as sales. Send out the circular every week, let people see what you have on sale, have them decide whether they want to shop at your store or not. Now, more and more stores are moving towards the loyalty card, as it's called within the industry, to be able to offer the same sale prices. Although the sale prices are not typically, are not necessarily the same type of sale prices that we had 5 or 10 years ago before the advent of the cards. Since they began using the cards, it's been tracked in markets where the cards were not in place that before the introduction of the cards, what would happen is the prices, the everyday prices, would become ratcheted up, and the sale price would actually be much closer to what had been the previous retail price. I'm going to read a bit here from the Giant Eagle Advantage Card Privacy Policy. This is available on their website. You can, in fact, sign up for the Advantage Cards online. I've taken the liberty of signing up a particular account here. I'll just leave these right there on the table so you can take them on your way out. I've also left some on the public information table. Anybody who attended Rubicon last year will be glad to know that these have been registered in the name of General Manager for the Marriott in Romulus, Michigan. From the privacy policy, Giant Eagle does not sell your personal information or purchase information gathered as a result of your participation in the Giant Eagle Advantage Card program. Giant Eagle has no plans to sell the information in the future. Giant Eagle does not share your personal information or purchase information with anyone except as requested or authorized by you, as necessary to complete a transaction initiated by you through the use of your card, to comply with subpoenas, court orders, or other legally binding mandates, or as necessary to enable us to offer you savings on products or services. I have no idea what is necessary to enable the offering savings on products or services, but I have to think that it seems to be a pretty flexible definition. There have been past abuses of the data that has been gathered through these channels. Some of the cases of interest include the DEA requesting information regarding people purchasing large quantities of baggies, presumably for use in drug transactions. Following the September 11th attacks, according to a former executive of a large unnamed grocery company, they offered their entire loyalty database, purchase history, and customer information to the FBI to help them find terrorists. This was done without being requested, without being solicited, and most importantly, without a warrant. There is the case of a grocery chain in California that had a customer slip, fall, and injure himself on their premises. The chain attempted to introduce into the ensuing trial that the customer may have been drunk at the time because of frequent alcohol purchases, which were tracked through his loyalty card. Moving away from the grocery store arena, the Foot Action Star Club actually has their membership information available through a list broker on the internet. Now, I didn't go looking at their privacy policy, but according to the list broker, this is an ideal method of reaching either Hispanic or African-American young men between the ages of 16 and 25. They, as the list broker sites put it, they view their footwear as more of a fashion statement than an athletic purchase. So it can be assumed by anybody who would be purchasing this list that they have cash and they're willing to spend it, which would be why it costs $90 per 1,000 names to be able to contact them. A company that you may be a little more familiar with recently was found to be selling their data direction that they would not be. Hooked on Phonics received a fine from the FTC regarding their privacy policy and ignoring it in selling their customer lists. So where are we going with all of this? What's happening in the future with retail stores and the data that they're collecting? There's an Ohio chain called Dorothy Lane Market. I don't know, is anybody here familiar with that? Well, apparently it's an upscale grocery chain. They've actually done away with sales flyers. What happens is when you go into their store, you swipe your card and it shows you a personalized ad sheet complete with personalized pricing. What they do is they offer the best prices to the most profitable customers, the ones who purchase the highest margin items. One of the areas that grocery stores in particular are starting to explore is the use of these cards in that customized pricing, not just at the ad sheet and at the checkout, but actually as part of the display within the store. What they're wanting to do is have it so that you wave your card or swipe it or however the card is read. And when you do so, it shows you the price of the item. Whether that happens at the display or as part of an integrated unit in the cart, that's yet to be decided. But both of those are avenues that are actively being explored right now. When you start pairing this with RFID tags, things start getting even more scary than they already are. An example of that is the Prada boutiques actually offer their frequent customers loyalty cards. And when you show up at one of their boutiques and offer your card, an associate can scan it. They can see your personal preferences, for instance, what size shirt you wear, what type of clothing you like, even who your favorite sales associate is, along with, of course, your purchase history. I think it'd be an interesting experiment to be able to grab that code for somebody who has the money and likes to shop there, and walk in there dressed as grungy as possible to see what kind of treatment you receive. Yeah, they offer a loyalty card, and they link that back to their central database, their central customer database. Yeah, but that's too inexact. Why bother looking at a customer when you can just swipe their card?
My point is that they do make weird adjustments. I had a couple from Birmingham who also obviously had money. They're aware the guy was wearing a $2,000 custom-made suit, I could tell. But they know most people don't typically buy antique furniture. You know, so, I mean, it is...
They have money and they don't know what they're doing. Easy mark.
You know, if you had something like that, they wouldn't care if you walked in and rented it out. If you passed their test, they're going to... The idea is, in other words, that the rich will end up buying stuff. The implications of people that have money are going to end up buying stuff that costs them below. For the poorer people, you've got a red line situation where the poorer people, in other words, are going to be paying more for the same goods.
Well, we already have that in many industries. We're now just getting it down to an exact science with customer tracking to this level. Brings me to my next topic that I want to discuss today, and that is RFID. I'm assuming that everybody here is familiar with RFID and what it means. Is there anybody that's not? Okay. Just a quick overview. RFID, radio frequency identification, is basically using very, very small microchips that have unique serial numbers burned into them. The packaging includes an antenna so that, and what it does is it allows you to pass an electromagnetic field through it, and it powers the device to transmit the unique identifier back. Basically, it allows for contactless scanning of cards, merchandise, people, whatever the RFID chip is placed into. RFID is going to become much more prevalent in the very near future. Walmart has mandated that its top 100 suppliers...
It works for Walmart.
Walmart. Walmart has mandated that its top 100 suppliers start using RFID tagging for pallets and cartons by January 1st, 2005. What Walmart wants, Walmart gets, particularly for its large suppliers. There are many stories out there about Walmart and its demands upon its suppliers and the things they have done to meet those requests, even to the detriment of their business. 12% of the economic productivity gains in the late 90s can be traced directly to Walmart, according to a study by McKinsey. Dial Corporation does 28% of its business through Walmart. In the year 2003, 7.5 cents out of every dollar spent at a store that was not an auto parts store was spent at Walmart. The only saving grace in this is that it is not at the item level yet. However, as RFID becomes more widely adopted and economy of scale starts taking over, it will become much cheaper to place the RFID tags directly into the merchandise.
Yeah, have you ever worked retail?
No.
Okay, because one of the big issues in retail is inventory tracking. Being able to, it is a huge cost to turn around and keep track of your actual inventory, what's walking out the door still, and be able to adjust to that inventory. I mean, they pay a lot of money for independent companies to come in and do inventory where they shut down the store and they try to figure out, okay, what's our real inventory? Because our book inventory says this, we may be nowhere near that real inventory, and so bring all of this stuff back online and figure out, and then to try and go back afterwards and say, all right, we got inventory 6 months ago, we obviously have a huge, you know, either employee or just, you know, walking out the door or something, but we're all of a sudden merchandising, we're figuring out 6 months later, you know, we've lost maybe 20% of our merchandise or something, and it could be that drastic.
Oh, sure. I'm not disputing the fact that it induces operational efficiencies.
There's huge costs in just maintaining, you know, what's going on. The pricing structure where, effectively, if your prices are off, you know, floor tagging and stuff like pricing is very expensive. And maintaining that, because prices are always going up and down in the retail market in order to match the actual environment, competitors, and things like that. So you've got basically every evening, you've got X number of employee hours retagging shelves.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, the idea of an RFID is that you can A, maintain your inventory levels properly. You can predict, you know, more actively and more quickly when you need reorder points. You can track when stuff is, you know, like actually like disappearing off the shelf, for instance, when your inventory is getting out of your variance between your book and your actual inventory is starting to grow. And with the pricing issue right off the bat, somebody brings something up and says, well, this says it's this much, and you charge me this much, and now I want, you know, 10 times the difference and all this kind of thing, you know.
I'm not saying that RFID is inherently bad, nasty, evil, or whatever. What I'm saying is that there needs to be appropriate controls in place so that people's privacy can be maintained.
Well, the thing is, any time when you're purchasing something to a certain extent, there is a record whether you use an RFID or not. What you purchase theoretically, you know, the idea is, okay, do you have a cash basis of being able to purchase things anymore at some point?
Oh, sure. Walmart maintains the largest data warehouse outside of the federal government.
And number two, you have the opportunity to disable those RFIDs, because at some point, some consumers, the idea is theoretically some consumers will want those RFID tags if they're, you know, left on potentially, so when they throw up, you know, items of groceries, say, in their you know, fridge, they can call up and,
well, sure. One example that's commonly used is the smart washing machine that will detect the RFID tags of the clothing placed in it and use the appropriate the water temperature, the type of action that's used within the washing machine itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are definitely some positive uses of the technology. The problem comes in with making sure that people who choose to maintain their privacy are able to do so. It can be very difficult. For instance, I believe it's Michelin tires either are currently or are planning on embedding RFID tags within the tires themselves. So, I mean, you could put a scanner in the road and be able to see when people are driving past you and know who that person is and what kind of tires they have and where they purchased them. I don't know about you, that's not the kind of information I would want out there. But particularly with items like tires, it's very problematic because the destruction of that RFID tag could be detrimental to the product itself, especially with anything where the tag is actually embedded in the product. Michelin's French, so I really don't think we need the RFID reason to boycott them. Florida, Georgia, and Tennessee have recently agreed to purchase 66,000 RFID tags and nearly 5,000 scanners. The technology that they're purchasing is called VeriChip. What it is meant to be, what the usage of this is to actually implant it into people. The states haven't come out yet and said what they're planning on doing with these VeriChips, but it can be assumed that it probably will be used on a segment of society that people are least likely to stand up for to defend. And the obvious example that comes to mind would be child molesters. I mean, who could argue against putting a chip into a child molester?
Well,
That's where it starts.
Once you have felons, then you get the guys who commit the misdemeanors.
Sure. When do you start chipping the jaywalkers?
Jaywalkers. Free hardware.
Well, actually, you can get that. If you go over to the Baja Beach Club in Barcelona, Spain, if you become a VIP there, you can get chipped for free. What they're selling this to their VIPs as a way of being able to purchase food and drinks and get entry to the VIP area without having to use cash or show a card or anything. Just wave your hand and you're in. What's that? In fact, in the article that I read regarding this, the owner, when asked how the chip would be received, said, "Yes, I know many people who want to be implanted. Actually, almost everybody has piercings, tattoos, or silicone." There is a retail chain in Germany by the name of Metro that has been making extensive use of RFID within the stores. There were some privacy activists who went over to take a look at it and met with Metro representatives. They went through the store, saw the signage that clearly says this item has an RFID tag in it, and explained what the implications are, and there's actually a station at the front of the store after you've made your purchases that you can deactivate the RFID chip in it. It wasn't until they were doing a presentation of their findings and showing the chipped items and waving them in front of the scanner that they found out that the loyalty card that the Metro store uses has an RFID chip in it also. This is something that was not disclosed to them by the store officials. This is something that's not disclosed to the customers through any of the literature, pamphlets, or in-store displays. Due to the backlash from finding the RFID chips that were embedded in the loyalty cards, the store agreed to stop putting the chips into the cards. Some of you may have heard about what Gillette is planning to do with RFID tags and using them on their razor replacements. The replacement cartridges for their razors. I mean, these things go for $20 or $30, so obviously, and combined with their small size and high value, it makes them a very heavy target for shoplifting. Gillette, through an RFID industry group, proposed an idea where the razor packaging would have an RFID chip embedded in it, and the display unit would have an RFID reader, so that when a package of razor blades was removed from the display, it would take a picture of the person who removed the packaging. So when you go and show up at the register without the razor blades, they would be able to ask you, "Hey, where's the razor blades you took?" I don't know what the current state of that proposal is right now, but I would anticipate that as we see more widespread adoption of the RFID technology, that they will begin using that.
Actually, you let this back down on that recently.
Thank you. Wow, I wasn't aware of that. Thank you very much. I want to just spend a few moments talking about an organization that you may not be aware of. The AAMVA is the American Association of Motor Vehicle Associations, I believe, or something like that. You can look it up on their website, aamva.org. They actually have the guidelines for what state-issued driver's licenses and ID cards should look like, what information they should contain, and most importantly, what data formats they should follow so that the licenses and IDs are interoperable with one another. This is what allows things like bars to be able to swipe your card and ensure that you're old enough to be there drinking. In fact, in the state of Ohio, it is an affirmative defense for a liquor serving establishment that if they are brought up on charges of allowing underage drinking, if they can show that they scan everybody's ID using a technology that validates the ID, that is something that will get them off the hook from the charge. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail here, but there are specifications freely available on the AAMVA.org website that will allow you to see where they're going as far as the information contained on licenses. Right now, the state of Ohio uses a simple 1D barcode that contains the driver's license or ID number. In the future, the current specs from the AAMVA stipulate that a 2D barcode should be used on the front of the license.
Illinois, we're from, we have a PDF 417 on the back that's in.
Yep. That's what AAMVA wants in all new licenses.
California uses track 1, track 2 mechanic strips.
Mm-hmm.
Are they looking at integrating biometrics to help?
Yes, the specifications do allow for biometric information to be contained within the machine-readable portions of a license or ID.
They're not pushing for it, though.
I'm not aware. I can't answer that.
Passport legislation, we just talked about that back there on the way in. I was listening to talk about some organization, the government, based or part of the passport. The countries that use passports instead of visas, that they tie their passport to biometric devices, and I guess they back off when it's something.
Well, not to pick on our French friends, but I believe they had something like 6,000 blank passports stolen pretty recently. I don't remember the numbers or the date, but they did have a significant quantity of passports stolen.
Also bear in mind, EU privacy laws are very, very different than US and much, much more strict.
Yes.
But I guess that's what I was kind of getting in is this look like it's a future trend or not? Biometrics and some of these.
Oh, I'm sure that it will be pushed more and more, particularly as we move beyond simple 1D and 2D barcodes or mag stripes and move more into smart chips or optical storage memory contained in the devices, both of which are technologies that the specifications are already out there for how they should be implemented by the motor vehicle associations.
What's that 1D and 2D? What are they signify?
One-dimensional versus two-dimensional barcode.
Yeah.
The UPC is a one-dimensional barcode. If you look at license.
So a barcode is normally at 1D.
Right.
And then 2D is...
Yeah, when you think barcode, you that's a 1D.
Of course, yeah.
If you look at, like, a UPS label, for instance.
This is a 2D barcode.
2D is like...
Oh, okay.
Yes, you see it? Looks like... I've seen that, once in my life.
Yeah, UPS labels have a form of 2D barcode. It's a different type than that one, but it's a 2D barcode that it allows much higher information density.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Well, what happened with the whole, there was a big issue about embedding information in these things, and the whole concept at one point, back a while ago, was the idea that you would hate it, that the way it should, theoretically, was the way it was headed was the idea that you had something that identified you in the database, the information, the data itself resided in totally separate databases that had proper restrictions put on them. So, for instance, you could get identified whether you go to a hospital or whether a police officer pulls you off over, but all it was you effectively the equivalent of a cookie, and they had to basically get ID back to their database so that the officer didn't see your medical records and your medical people saw nothing like the traffic, etc.
That's where we're going with this. Thank you for introducing the topic. MATRIX is the Multi-State Anti-Terrorism Information Exchange. So how does information exchange become IX instead of IE? I guess they didn't want to sound Australian or something. I don't know. Obviously, it was not somebody that's too familiar with the movies that came up with the idea for this. What the Matrix is a private company called Seisint down in Florida has been purchasing publicly available records for several years now. They recently received a federal grant of $15 or $16 million to basically begin creating a state-run version of TIA, Total Information Awareness. By pushing it down to the state level, it removes the federal government from having to deal with any of the privacy concerns involved in running it. Just really brief on the Matrix. The state of Ohio is one of the participants in it. They were one of the original participants, and they are still one of the participants. Several states, including, I believe, Pennsylvania and New Jersey, have recently backed out of supplying data and being part of this because of the privacy concerns that were involved.
Are you saying basically that this could end up being kind of like the library issue where the government says, all right, well, we're not pushing this work because we don't want to do a patent version, but on the other hand, we're going to basically tell all these states that you should implement this or we're going to withhold funding on you so that you have to deal with the privacy concerns?
That's potential down the road. It certainly hasn't been beyond the federal government to withhold funding to push whatever agenda they wish. One that comes to mind would be the minimum age to purchase alcohol. Well, you don't have to make it 21, but you don't have to have federal highway funds either. Basically, you had to accede to the wishes or forego the federal highway funds.
So
sure, we hear about unfunded mandates all the time. Why should this be any different? One of the protections that they claim to afford for records contained within Matrix are that you have the right to correct any information that is wrong in there. You don't do that centrally. You do that through the authority which initially published the information that was included. The problem is that you're not allowed to simply request your records. So you would have to go to pretty much every state agency and find out whether they've published information, what they've published, and whether it's actually accurate or not. One example of organizations that publish information is the state of Ohio, the BMV. If you have a state-issued driver's license, and if you've had one any time in the past 4 years, you are in there. That's been through there are apparently 16 criteria by which an organization can request and utilize data of the BMV, stuff like car insurance is an example of authorized requests. According to state officials, Seisint meets the criteria on 10 of the 16. And for all of this wealth of personal and private information, they've paid the princely sum of $56,000 over the past 4 years. I'm going to spend a few minutes here now talking about a man-in-the-middle attack. There is a service called MarketScore that what they claim to do is to be an internet accelerator. And how they accomplish this is by using their own proxy servers. What they do is reconfigure a computer with the user's permission to use the MarketScore computers or the MarketScore proxy servers. The privacy angle on this is the obvious. If you're going through their proxy server, they can see everything you're doing. The not-so-obvious one is the fact that as part of the installation of the Market Score application, what they do is they actually install two trusted root CA certs to a user's computer. What they use those to do is to subsequently take information from... Let me give you an example. Let's say you want to sign into your, your bank's online banking application. What happens in a in an SSL transaction is that the browser issues a request to the server responds with its certificate, and the browser checks the validity of the certificate. It's user configurable from simply making sure that the domain name or the host name and domain name match what the certificate says it is, all the way to optionally being able to go against a certificate revocation list maintained by the CA to make sure that that certificate is not only valid but is also, has also not yet been revoked. What Market Score does is break the SSL connection on their proxy server. When a Market Score enabled computer makes an SSL request, it's SSL from the client to the proxy, and it's terminated at the proxy, and then it's SSL, the proxy initiates SSL from the proxy against the remote site. During that time in the middle, while you're on that proxy, your SSL connection is broken, and the information that you have in that data stream is available in clear text. I want to read a little bit from the privacy statement from Market Score regarding the use of their service. Market Score monitors your surfing, essentially logging information about the web pages that you visit and the actions that you take, such as purchases and transactions you make. Market Score can only monitor the internet behavior and activity of your household's registered and configured computers. As a member, you therefore control which computers the Market Score service is enabled on. Market Score monitors both the normal web browsing you perform and the activity you may have through secure sessions, such as when filling a shopping basket or filling out an application form. Market Score's proprietary and patent-pending technology allows us to see the details of secure pages while protecting such content from parties other than the site to which you are connected. We monitor the internet connections of our users so we can accurately and anonymously model the browsing habits of internet users, but also their shopping, registration, and other interactions as well. Although we generally monitor your internet behavior as part of this service, Market Score does not analyze the content of or keep any instant messages you send, nor do we analyze or use the contents of any of your email messages, except to perform specific functions necessary to provide you the Market Score service, such as scanning your emails to effectively search for viruses, and as a quality assurance check against and method for verifying information on the surfing and buying behavior of Market Score members. So basically, what they're saying is they're admitting that they gather the information from those SSL sessions. I don't know about any of you here, but most of the things that I do under SSL, I really wouldn't want anybody and everybody to be able to have access to, let alone people that have already said, hey, we're going to sell some of your information. Within their terms of service, they state that if we change our practices in how we handle personally identifiable information, or if we materially change other aspects of our service, we will notify you by posting proposed changes to this privacy statement area. To this privacy statement and on our website. The changes will be effective immediately upon such posting. If you do not agree with any of the changes, you may cancel your membership as described above. The problem with this is that the Market Score service is not one that requires you to access your browser to access their website. After you've registered for the service and set it up on a computer, you have no further need to visit the website of Market Score. So any of the changes they make could take place without without you necessarily knowing about it unless you actually go to their website to find out about it.
But that's actually more ubiquitous. I mean, even Google is running a test right now where they're offering 100 meg of...
1 gig.
You know, with the proviso that they can scan your email.
Mm-hmm.
Have you archived.org that document?
I beg your pardon?
Have you archived.org that document?
I'm not familiar with that. Can you...
Archive.org has a history of every web page ever.
Okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. So basically to get a feel for how often that policy changes. No, I haven't. That all brings us to what we can do about this. Obviously, there's some pretty frightening things going on out there. The most important thing is to be discreet with your information. What you share and who you share it with. I've been in a video store before where I was asked for my social security number in order to sign up for a card. Beg your pardon?
It's the end of that.
Well, I had no problem with just saying, is there any way we can do this without my social security number? I said, nope, that's store policy. I said, well, personal policy, I can't rent videos here then. Protect your social security number. Vital. Not everybody who requests it needs to have it. Some organizations can be flexible with that. Attach conditions to your shared data. Make sure that if you're sharing private or sensitive information, that it will be handled in accord with your wishes. One example of this is, and I noticed this, I thought this was kind of strange upon checking into this hotel, that I was not required to show an ID. However, at other hotels where I've stayed, I have been required to show ID. In fact, they have asked to make a copy of it. I asked very clearly what would be done with it, where it would be stored, how would it be handled, who would have access to it, and whether or not it would be returned to me after my stay was completed. After answering all of the questions to my satisfaction, I was willing to let them have a copy of my ID. But it's very important to make sure that the people handling it know what you want done with it. Ask to inspect and correct files where law permits you to. Credit reports, consumer investigations, school records, federal agency files, cable records, and criminal records all have provisions under the law regarding accuracy and what you need to do in order to change that information. I'm not saying that it necessarily will be an easy endeavor, whether it's to find the person that's responsible for maintaining the information or to effect any necessary changes to it, but it is something that the law does allow you to do. My understanding is this may have changed recently with the implementation of the federal Do Not Call list. I'm unfortunately not familiar with whether the Telephone Consumer Protection Act of 1991 still applies to unsolicited telemarketing calls on behalf of businesses. I don't recall seeing anything that said the federal Do Not Call list superseded the TCPA of 1991.
No, they still both work together.
Okay. When a telemarketer does call, request to be placed on their Do Not Call list, that's something that they have to do according to federal law. Not only that, they also have to provide you, upon request, a copy of their Do Not Call policy. When I've gotten calls from telemarketers that have been very less than pleased about my requests, I've forced them to take the extra step of providing me with that policy. Typically, it's sent through the mail. If they don't send you that policy, or if they do continue to contact you, you actually have a private right of action where you can sue for $500 per offense. If in the opinion of the judge, the violation of the TCPA was willful and with full knowledge, then you can receive up to $1,500 per offense. And I have actually successfully sued and or settled with AT&T and the Akron Beacon Journal. Another important thing is to keep abreast of current technology and where it's going, what's coming down the pipeline. Stuff like the RFID or biometric identification or any of the other proposed changes with how the licenses and IDs are handled. It's very important to be aware of what's going on so that you can protect your information. Does anybody have any questions?
It's interesting to me that I've noticed that AT&T has violated the do not call procedure with me as well. I mean, is there anything that cites them as a major violator of that on a larger level?
Yes, states are able to, the state attorney general's office is able to bring action against telemarketing abuse also. As part of my research for my case against AT&T, I found that they had been investigated and had either sued or had fines levied against them by 15 different state attorneys general. So, I mean, it was pretty clear that there was a definite pattern of abuse present.
Part of the problem is, like you mentioned, is this is the laws have been there forever, and the companies, in fact, the companies involved in this realize that enforcement either doesn't happen or it's too expensive to actually follow up on, so that they're totally ineffective. And a couple of cases where I've seen people actively going out of their way to bring lawsuits against this, I've seen a couple of cases where people basically came up with a personal life vendetta thing where they were going to try and bring some compliance and were actively going out of the way to chase down and enforce this to a certain extent. They admitted flat out basically that it cost them way more than they to actually pursue this.
That it cost who, the person or the organization?
It was individuals who were doing this, okay, that basically were trying to, you know, sue, you know, based on this, and they're keeping documents and documentation, everything else, recording phone calls, and all this other process of doing this. It was costing them more, in time and other things, to do this than, you know, way more than what they ever got out of it. That the only reason that they could justify this was just it was that much of an issue. So for the rest of us, we're kind of left in a situation where, okay, so the loss of whatever, but it's useless.
Yeah.
Law is only as useful as it can be enforced, and so, you know.
Well, that's why the TCPA is so important, is because it pushes the enforcement right down to the individual, the aggrieved party.
People were actually using to enforce this was the TCPA. Mm-hmm. Bring up lawsuits, and they were getting, you know, thousands of dollars, or, you know.
Right, but keep in mind there is something that a lot of people don't understand. I had problems with AT&T myself. The minute you say, if you call me ever again, I'm filing a lawsuit, they can no longer talk to you. They have to move you up to a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Your supervisor then picks you off the list.
Yes.
Well,
no, you don't have to say, I'm going to file a lawsuit. You simply have to say, I wish to be placed on your do not call list.
That's all you have to say, but if they're harassing you and calling constantly, which AT&T was.
Oh, sure, I got called 4 times in 5 days.
The minute you say lawsuit, their lawyers require them to move you to a supervisor.
Okay, that's company policy, not federal law.
Exactly, that's AT&T, but for a lot of these companies, they basically just blow you off because they know, you know, the amount of money that they're going to have to pay out lawsuits, and this is one of the things that got brought up and people are pursuing this, was that for the vast majority of companies, you know, not necessarily talking about a big company like AT&T, but for the vast majority of companies, they know that the money they'll ever have to pay out is inconsequential, you know, compared to the amount of money they will generate through basically pestering the hell out of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no motivation for them becoming compliant. Even though the laws basically, you know, theoretically provide for this, reality is exactly the opposite. The financial
aspects of it is that it is just too lucrative for them to basically actually follow the court of law.
Well, the only thing you can do is make sure that people around you know. Whenever I hear somebody saying, wow, I wish those telemarketers would just leave me alone, use that as the perfect introduction. Get paid for getting annoyed.
Most people know that effectively, if I try to institute a lawsuit, that I might get $500 or $1,500, and it costs me way more time and money to do it, so it just drops.
I think that's kind of the principle of the thing.
Yes.
How many people, realistically, you know of that will actually invest that much of their life into a principal thing?
I don't know. I took General Motors to court because I wanted a car. I mean,
it's a small percentage of the population, is my point. Not unfortunately.
Well, that's going to be the, 90% of everything is crap argument. I mean, there's always going to be a smaller amount of people who are less apathetic.
Yes.
I think that's,
That's why you're here.
Right.
Yeah, there's all the rest of the people, and then there's us.
I guess, do you have any recommendations on resources to make it cost-effective to bring action against these people in terms of...
Sure. If you go to www.consumer.net, they have scads of information on the TCPA and how you should keep your records, what you should say, and how you should deal with it if they don't comply.
But I guess here's the thing.
Take it to the state attorney general. As I said, there are over a dozen attorneys general who have gone after AT&T alone.
And then there's the new national do not call registry.
Yes.
After you file with them, 30 days, they will take care of filing.
Yeah, and hopefully that'll be good. But as far as like the tracking information and stuff like that, it seems like you almost have to come up with a kind of like an open source alternative to it, where people are contributing to some mechanism for tracking who's tracking and how you turn around and track all this stuff, et cetera, where different people are contributing to this and you build a database of how you turn.
So privacy advocates gathering their information collectively. Interesting idea.
How to track who's tracking who and how do you turn around and basically correct information? FuckCompany.com.
I was going to say that's hard because there's too many little things to track. For instance, somebody sent me something just as a joke. Oh, Polly, go to this site. I went to sites called like birthday.com. They had my year, my date of birth. They had my name and they had my address.
Great friends you've got, huh?
I was like, my social security number and you've got a credit card. and I contacted him. I was like, I will call you a lawyer, get my stuff off your site. The only thing that made me pull this stuff was the threat of a lawyer.
Well, that's what I mean. It's basically, if you actually start some mechanism of trying to consolidate that information in a centralized format where people could actually go to it and find out, there are these various issues, but right now it's just a scattershot approach.
Well, it's pretty easy to find abusing companies just through doing a web search for them. Plenty of people are willing to put up their stories in dealing with companies and trying to receive redress for their grievances.
But there's still not an effective central distribution of that information to a wide variety, to a wide group of people.
I don't think we'll ever see that.
It's a piecemeal kind of approach that I don't think would succeed. Without some form of organization and distribution of information, it just doesn't seem like, it's an effective. You've got an organized group that's basically collecting the information and a disorganized group that's trying to basically fight that, the misinformation that's getting put in, et cetera. And, so who's going to win, the organized or the disorganized group,
Money. Where are the monies at?
As always.
One other thing, separate issue, that they're seeing a lot of other things that's starting to creep into a lot of software where basically they're starting to bury things in their effective use policies, kind of like, say, you go to download it, like a real player and it effectively buried in there says...
You downloaded it? That's what real alternatives for, so you don't get all that crap.
Yeah, so, it's like, well, we of course have the right to, monitor and sell information we gather from monitoring and stuff. You're starting
the various users agreements on a lot of software that people have been using, and it's just all of a sudden, just within the last last 6 months or so, it seems like it's just exploded on how many of these companies are basically turning into effectively spyware.
Yes. By the way, that does actually bring up an interesting note that I forgot to touch on regarding Market Score. The Market Score application is identified accurately by AdAware as spyware. Thank you.